Jobs gives the truth to the best of your knowledge.
I do.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Need a reminder.
I got it, Tim.
Okay,
I'm right here.
I'm trying to help.
I'll remind the representative from the assessor's office that she is still under oath. I'm not sure which of these we're hearing together.
I am here for the vacant lots, lots 13 through 30, well, not through 31, but Morse Corner. There's 14 accounts.
Okay, hold on just a second, and I will find the right document.
And this is
the one that says all other scheduled members, at least on my book.
Is that the one it is?
Yeah, all other schedules.
Do you mind if we start with the vacant lot?
No, please.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and read these account numbers then. So this is Mountain Meadow Preserve LLC, and the account numbers we're considering currently are R816-7626, R816-7627, R816-7628, R816-7629, R816-7630, R816-7632, R816-7633, R816-7634, R816-7635, and is this the correct number? The one with asterisks? Okay. R816-7636, R816-7637, R816-7638, R816-7643, and R816-7644. So I have some introductory comments, and if the other petitioners in the room want to listen up, I won't have to repeat these later. The issue of today's proceeding is property valuation and or classification for assessment purposes, not property taxes. No discussion of taxes will be allowed. The petitioner shall present his or her evidence first and shall have the opportunity to cross-examine the representatives from the assessor's office after they have presented their evidence. The assessor's office must produce information to support the basis and amount of the assessor's valuation of the property or classification if that is what is being contested. Where the comparable sales method is used, state statute provides that the assessor will determine value based on sales during the 18-month period ending June 30th, 2018. Sales may also be considered in 6-month increments immediately preceding the 18-month period up to 5 years if there are insufficient sales to obtain accurate comparable valuation data. Smaller counties commonly use a 24-month period in order to obtain sufficient comparable sales data that better demonstrates the change in value from the prior level of value June 30th, 2016. The 24-month period also eliminates seasonality from the sales data. Rowell County uses a 24-month data collection period. The petitioner and the assessor should not discuss sales post June 30th, 2018, except in cases when it can be demonstrated that a contract for sale was completed prior to June 30th, 2018 and closed after June 30th, 2018, according to the original contract. Under Colorado law, the present value of your property cannot be considered. The decision of this board may be appealed, and we will refer to that after the decision or motion has been made. If you have any exhibits that you wish the board to consider, please distribute those now, and make sure to give one to our secretary for marking. So we'll go ahead and start with the petitioner. So if you would give us a summary of the basis of your appeal.
Page one.
We are on page 74 of the full packet.
Okay, well.
Go over here to the that guy. Then it's going to be the one that says all other. This is the staff packet.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I don't know why it's not showing up for you, though. It's just blank. All right.
I lost my mind.
I have a copy. Do you want a paper copy?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, sir, will you... I'm sorry, we didn't take your name earlier. Will you state your name for us, please?
Bruce Shugart.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Shugart, will you go ahead and summarize the basis of your appeal for us?
I am here today just to discuss I got some documents. Did you want to start with the...
No, you go first.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
All right. I didn't know where
that's
where
fine.
At, so.
Assessor's office goes after.
1291, Attorney Leaf Court. And the basis on that is the square footage and the
assessment. I'm sorry,
is this the vacant lots?
We're talking.
No, that was on a vertical.
Okay, we're doing the vacant lots.
Yeah.
The Morris Corner vacant lot.
That's what I thought. This is different.
So the accounts that we're considering right now are lots 13
right.
through 31 of Morris Corner.
That's not me. Yeah. I'm a developer over there, but I'm
okay.
also representing a particular one, and that's why I ask if you want to stay with the vacant lots mindset.
So I'm sorry, we don't have a petitioner here for the vacant lots. Is that correct? Okay.
I thought you did all of that area, that whole.
Okay.
It's all right.
You're just doing improvements.
Up.
Okay.
So you are not representing the petitioner for the purpose of these vacant lots.
I am. I'm sorry. I'm a little. I just
okay.
got back from a 3-week holiday, okay. and I am a little behind. So I developed the porches, and yes, I'm representing that. I don't have the documentation though. You have.
Okay. These are available online.
Correct. I mean,
right now we're discussing the vacant lots.
Right,
so we're going to take these
different.
One at a time. So this is not related to those vacant lots.
That's correct.
Okay, so we'll hold on to this
correct.
Until we get to that one. We're talking about the vacant lots
that's
right
correct.
Now. Okay, so you first have the opportunity to present the basis for your appeal, and then the assessor's office will follow you.
I have a technical question.
Yes.
I sort of want to go farther here, because he needs to be authorized. Who are the owners
yeah.
of these things? He needs to be authorized to be
their representative.
To be the rep, so...
Caitlin McKenzie was her taxation at assessor level appeal, and on the...
I mean, we can just ask, are you authorized to represent the owner of these properties?
You are the owner.
I am the owner.
Okay, well, I think he's authorized.
It seems likely.
And then my technical question is, do we have in front of us the requested amount for the valuation for these properties, or are we about to hear about that? Because what we have, all we have, is what the assessor has determined what
yeah.
the valuation of these properties are. So presumably, you're here asking for a reduction in valuation.
But we need from you a number in terms
we need
of
a
what
dollar
you're
number
requesting.
Why.
Thank you, Tim. Yes.
I now understand where we're at. So there were three. There were properties at what we call P1. The main part, there was the bulk property, and there was a 1291 in question. There were three things out at the porches.
Mm-hmm.
The only one I'm here contesting is 1291.
Okay. So I believe there was an appeal filed, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
14
so the Board of Equalization. So I...
And they did. I'm sorry.
So the assessor's office has the opportunity to approve or deny that, and it sounds like that was denied, and it was
mm-hmm.
appealed to the Board of Equalization. So am I to understand that you do not intend to appeal?
That is a true statement
decision?
And my error.
Okay. So I would say then, related to the property or the account numbers that were just listed, that we would deny the appeal, which was filed.
I would have a motion that we withdraw them
okay.
if he did not intend to go to the
okay.
CBOE. And
I don't know that we can withdraw them, though. Who can do that?
The petitioner can.
Okay.
Okay.
So we just need to note for the record then, probably
that the petitioner intends to withdraw.
The petitioner is withdrawing.
Okay. So that would be for those items.
Hey,
and then
I'm good with that.
Fine, please. Makes our job easy. And then what's the second one? We can read those into the record as well and do the same thing.
The three properties are maps, and I don't know if you are those going to be withdrawn also. And then the one, your 1269 turning leaf, is that you, Kevin?
I'm not sure that's the address.
It's 1291.
1291. It ends in 289.
1291.
Here, that's you? Okay.
So the other I have here from Mountain Meadows, LLC, I believe, well, I'm not clear. So we have three, or do we only have two in front of us? So the other I see here is the legal description is future expansion parcel porches 2, filing 1. So the common elements.
And that was also not, was to be non-challenged.
So you are withdrawing that petition as well,
yes.
or that appeal as well. So that's R6256380. And the petitioner is withdrawing
the appeal to the BOE.
You're making our day real easy.
No, I really, I may have had years, but I really apologize to everybody else.
Yeah, I'm sure to the assessor's office.
I really apologize for that.
28B is 12.
So now, this is the one we're going to be listening to.
Let me find my...
Lots 36B, 29B, and 28B.
I think it's just 28B, right? Is that the one? Just the one?
Believe,
just this account number?
I believe so. It 29B.
29B.
29 Bravo, yeah.
Okay, so which of these account numbers
is 29B?
Is 29B. I see three things listed together.
Right.
So that's 1291, Turning Leaf Court.
Correct.
So that's account R816-8289. Is that what you have?
What's that now?
R816-8289.
Correct.
All right. So then I believe that R817-3864 and R816-8859 are being withdrawn as well. The appeals on
right.
those properties. Is that correct?
I'm not swearing in.
Yeah,
we swore you in last
we
time.
Swore
it carries over.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're
fine. I'll remind you that you're still sworn in.
Yeah.
So you are still sworn in. Don't worry. Thank you for that. Okay, so we then are just hearing an appeal on account number R816-8289.
Correct.
And I believe the documents that you attempted to distribute earlier are...
For this.
Yeah, no, keep everything straight. That's good for us.
And again, if I'm not mistaken, there was nothing in our packet around the notice of determination where a proposed lowered valuation was listed. We're just going to be seeing that now, I take it.
This is going to be, his justification. That's what he's going to make.
Right.
I think Commissioner Corgan is requesting. For the petitioner to state what the proposed value is.
Because the assessor's value is $2,306,230, correct?
Well, no, because there's... Oh, yes, that's right.
Yep.
$2,306,230.
So I would ask the petitioner, are you presenting a proposal for a lower valuation?
Yes, sir.
And what is that amount?
I don't have that number in front of me. It was based on square footage is all. The staff put together was based on 51...
5,112
mm-hmm.
is and, what I see in your packet.
And the proposal is for 4,612.
So your request is to remove 500 square feet...
Correct.
At the same valuation.
Correct.
Per square foot.
Per square foot.
Okay, so if we were to just do a quick calculation on that so we know that number, that would be great.
So we'll take your... if we summarize then, he's asking, he doesn't have a problem with the per square footage price. He's asking the difference between 5,112 and 4,612.
I'll get you that calculation.
Okay, so we'll just, we'll have that number ready here, and then, so if you would go ahead and give us the justification for that, that would be great for your request.
My belief, without, 100% knowledge, is that the 5,112 may have been figured when the garage was, in fact, usable in office space. It is not any longer. The house by the architect CAD drawings is a little over 4,400 square feet. The appraisal that we just received, just meaning in 16, I believe, 119-6-2016 on real property from the ASI appraisal group here in Steamboat, listed it at the 4,612. And so I'm just making a petition for correction.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll let the assessor's office
respond to that proposal and give us some information here. So, I assume you didn't have this information previously. So
in the Route County, we value all property according to the ANSI measuring standard. And that's the exterior of the property, and then we deduct for open to below areas, which could be, you know, great rooms or staircases that don't have floor area incorporated into them. Really, we can't verify this appraisal or the square footage right at this exact moment to have a decision. It wasn't presented to us as a square footage issue. It was presented as a valuation issue. Okay. So we applied the best comparable sales with the information we had at the time, which was also what it's listed for on its multiple listing service as of the appraisal date. I would certainly do an inspection and remeasure the property to verify if there is a discrepancy. 500 square foot would certainly make a difference in the valuation.
Because that's the method that you used to arrive at the value was a value per square foot.
Yes, correct.
So I guess I'm a little confused about what happened here and why this wasn't addressed at the assessor level of appeal.
More into the fact of whether we even, I mean, if we make a motion to back up the per footage square price, you know, and then have the assessor's office back into the right numbers, whatever the numbers are.
I mean, we can't adjust the square footage of a home, can we? That's the BOE. I mean, we could adjust the valuation, or just evaluate. I mean, we don't even do that. We just adjust the valuation overall.
But we would have to have justification, and the justification to reduce the valuation is the lower amount of square foot, and we have no way to confirm whether or not that's the case at this point.
Well, and what I really think that the petitioner probably would like is for the assessor's office to adjust the square footage to reflect what he believes is the actual square footage, which we don't have the ability to do either
And it's way. Unfortunately too late at this point in time.
And we don't have the measuring standard that the appraiser used, which could be different from ANSI, which, you know, we want to value all properties equitably using the same measuring standard.
Right.
So that's really important in that regard.
No, we need to make sure that all of them apples to apples.
Exactly.
And we're measuring everybody's house in the same manner.
Exactly.
So for the record, why don't you describe once again that standard that you use and how that's applied?
So the ANSI measuring standard is...
And what stands for American National Standards Institute?
Yes, correct. So it's exterior square footage for a townhome, and then we deduct for open-to-below areas such as stairwells or great rooms, and additionally, below grade is treated as basement. Essentially. So any below grade areas.
Is the basement included in your square footage calculations?
Yes.
So
the basement's accounted for.
If, in fact, the petitioner had been able to demonstrate that the basement square footage was, in fact, unusable, would you have made an adjustment at the appeal level?
Well, I believe I did do an interior review on this at the assessor level, and the basement was finished.
So it's a question of it being finished or unfinished.
Well, not even that, I don't think. It's just, most likely, it's the measuring standard that the appraiser used. They maybe did interior airspace. They maybe treated it like a condo. There's no sketch even on the appraisal to see it.
So I have a question. And if you don't know the answer to this, it's okay, but as far as you're aware, is there a process by which this could be resolved for you to verify the square footage?
Absolutely. Just go out there and measure it.
But, I mean, based on where we are right now with this appeal, I mean, if we were to...
We don't have a method to kick it back to the assessor.
I just don't know.
No. Well, they have to appeal to the next level.
They still have the ability to correct the inventory.
I guess my real question is, if we, like, let's say that we denied it, could the assessor's office still make an adjustment based on new information?
Only if they appeal to the next level, we can come and look at it then and stipulate if something is incorrect at that time.
Well, that sounds fine, too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so we,
if we deny it, then
yeah.
we can
then we'll measure it. And then he still preserves his ability to further appeal. They can meet with them and make sure that everybody's still on the same get on the same page.
So I think wait.
Could I suggest something?
You
to
may
make it easier. Can I withdraw this?
You can.
Let's do that.
Absolutely. That's your prerogative.
Easy. Yeah.
That's
yeah. Well, there was. I had someone involved doing this whole thing, and then they went on. Bottom line is, we had
it's
too
okay.
many things going. It's very confusing.
We know how that goes.
I apologize to everybody. Let's just withdraw it and move on.
That's fine.
You got that?
Got it.
Get my business card from downstairs and give me a call, and we can schedule it anytime.
Yeah, well, then that's fine. I appreciate it, and I understand how you do it. And we have CAD files and stuff like that, but not in. We'll do it next time when we're more organized.
Sure.
That sounds
okay.
great. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Thank you very much.
No,
yeah.
I appreciate it. No, this
absolutely.
This is completely my call, so I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you need this old paperwork?
No, I'm done.
Okay. I think we're all right. Thank you very much.
I'll get rid of it. I'll get rid of it.
Okay.
Thanks for your time,
yeah.
today.
Yeah, thank you.
I apologize for taking you.
That's all right.
I'm trying to see what's next here. So, yeah, Catamount. Catamount.
Yeah, I have one. Yeah, Matt has the yeah.
And we'll hear those separately, I assume?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Get some goodies out of here.
Whichever you want to do first.
Okay, I'm going to just, let me just take a look here.
Okay.
So which one are we starting with?
Give us the schedule.
You're so impatient.
Hold on.
No, I'm just... Yeah, whatever you prefer,
well,
Susan, is fine. No, I understand.
No,
let's do the golf course.
So give us a schedule number.
816-4217 and 18, and 816-4221.
I'm sorry. Would you repeat those slowly?
R 816-4217.
Yeah.
And 18. So the same numbers, but
yeah.
ending in 8.
It's on page 95.
And yeah. R 816-4221.
I have the staff packet yet.
Okay.
Okay, so we're looking at parcels 1, 2, and 5 at Catamount Ranch, which is the golf course property. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So Susan just stated the numbers. Are you all right, Deanna? Okay.
So, handouts?
Yeah.
Here, I'll take the notebooks too. Oh, that's all right. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to read this all in the next few minutes.
No, I'll summarize. I'll try.
Obviously, Doug knows you. Will you tell
me? I'm Tom Downey.
Hi, Tom.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to see you, Tom.
Yep.
Good to see you.
My role is a pleasure.
All right. So you've heard my spiel. You've been sworn in. The representatives from the assessor's office are still under oath. So we'll go ahead and let you give your evidence first, please.
Thank you. I've presented a packet of information to you. Now, briefly, there's a little table of contents, but essentially after tab 1, I have a series of pages which review a number of things relating to this property that I'll review in more detail. Tab 2 is simply a property record card that we keep in our office, and it's a good summary of the outline of the values of these three parcels that we're looking at. Overall value is $9,205,230 with $7,691,750 of that attributable to the land.
So I'm going to stop for just a second, because I think that what the number you just read us is under the 1920. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and just for reference, we consider 2018 value. Is that right?
No, we're...
Would I understand that correctly?
We're doing the 2019 value.
Correct. Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
These are the values that appear on the assessor's records for the 2019 evaluation.
Okay.
It's just a summary. After tab 3, you'll have the actual property record cards from the assessor's office themselves. Tabs 4 and 5 have some data with respect to land sales utilized by the assessor in the county. I'll talk about that as we go through. And then after tab 6, I have a number of articles that relate to a topic that we're both going to talk about today, and that's the issue of economic obsolescence as it relates to the valuation of golf courses. The primary basis for the petitioner's protest of this property and further appeal to this board is we simply don't think that this has a market value of $9,200,000. We think that the value is significantly lower. We asked for a value of $5 million. And as I go through today, I'm going to try and explain to you why we think there's such a discrepancy in that difference. First, with respect to this golf course, I think you all know where it is, just as you're coming into town. It was created back in 1998. It was really an overall land development project. There were 26 or 27 multiple-acre residential parcels that were designed around this golf course. And as is often the case with many golf courses, the golf course was designed as an amenity and really an attraction to sell lots. The lots have sold out. The golf course is there. Back in, you know, before everything hit the fan back in the whole world, especially up here, 2007, 2008, they had a full membership. Almost full. The membership is capped at 375 golf memberships and 140 out at the lake. In 2008, when the world changed, they were almost full. They had 360 golf members and 35 at the lake. And then I show you there behind tab 1 what the membership has looked like over the last 4 to 5 years. Generally speaking, there's been a decline in the last 10 years of those full memberships of about 22%. This concept of external obsolescence, and it's particularly appropriate when the county is valuing this property on a cost approach basis. So when you do a cost approach, the first thing you do is you put a value on the land. You look and you see what that land value is. The county has valued the land at roughly, it's 119,000 an acre. 19,000 an acre. Too many zeros today. 19,000 an acre. And then they go through and they do what they call replacement cost new of the improvements that are there, as well as the golf course improvements that are in the fairways. Then you apply concepts of depreciation. There's physical depreciation, which generally relates to, for the majority of it, it relates to age, condition, etc. Marshall Swift has some tables that allow you to calculate that on a couple different bases. People argue about whether those tables are good or not. Some people say that they're multiple regression tables. Some people say that they're based on data, and in fact, they are based on data of sales from all over the country and not necessarily during the 18 months that we're talking about. But I don't want to fight about the depreciation tables today. Just I want to point out that the concept of depreciation is an issue here. Our issues with the land value and the depreciation. We think the land value is significantly less. And I'm going to kind of walk through that. We think the land value is in the range of $8,000 to $12,000 an acre. And again, I will tell you, in all honesty, this is based on some preliminary information. I've consulted with an appraiser who's done quite a bit of work in this community. I've worked with him in the past. We've worked with this particular appraiser who at this point I'll leave unnamed, but in connection with other appeals involving this county. He's a reputable person. He does good work. So some of the data I have is just preliminary information, not a full-blown appraisal, from consulting with an appraiser. That's where I get this range of $8,000 to $12,000. So that's the issue on the land. On the depreciation side, we have some issues with the counties, both their physical depreciation. We don't think it's quite enough given a property that's almost 20 years old. And the other end of the depreciation is this economic depreciation or obsolescence. And Matt's report gives a pretty good description of what external or economic obsolescence is. There are factors outside impacting the property. In this particular case, I think there are two elements to this external or economic obsolescence. One relates to the golf course industry in and of itself. Some of the articles in the back, and I don't think there's any general dispute about this, the golf course industry in the 90s and the early 2000s kind of really got way out over its skis. They very much overbuilt golf courses. There were new golf courses opening every day, it seemed. And in any event, I think some statistics indicate that they maybe got as much as 44% overbuilt. So then, we talked about 2008. Of course, there are a number of things impacting the golf industry. Certainly, the economy, as we all live through it. There are other issues as well. And there's some statistics back and forth on this. You know, some statistics indicate that younger folks are not as attracted to the golf game as maybe middle-aged or older folks like myself. So there's some statistics that indicate that participation levels are down. We also know that in the last 10 years, statistics out of the National Golf Foundation say that there have been 800 golf courses that have closed. And we know that of that 800, 200 closed in 2017, 200 closed in 2018. Why is any of this important? It's important because in looking at the potential market for a buyer of a golf course, we've got what appears to be declining utilization. There was an article in the Boulder Daily Camera today that quoted some of these national golf statistics. Participation is down 20% in the past 15 years. I mentioned the number of closures. What I didn't mention is apparently there were 14 that closed in Colorado within the last decade or so. There was a new one that opened last year. But the concept of this external obsolescence from the industry goes to who's my buyer? You know, who will be my buyer? I think there's another very important aspect that I must admit that initially I didn't really focus on either. But that's this particular market, okay? So we looked at how many rounds of golf are typically played at a typical golf course. I consulted with some golf course managers in Denver. I spoke to the Colorado Golf Association. I quote a number in here, a range of 22 to 28,000 rounds per year at an average course, non-mountain course, Colorado. Call it 25,000, it's in the middle of that range. What are they playing at this golf course? They average about 8,500 a year. We know, you know better than I do, that your golf season up here is pretty short. It's really, they're open June, July, and August, and September, God willing, depending on if the snow comes early or not. So you've got a season that's about 122 days, which is probably at least half of what it should be, half of what it would be, maybe even as much as 60%. These are more, and it's just a function of where it is. Someone who would want to buy this course would want to know. And the other thing, and you know, and I say this from some experience, I've done a few of these over the umpteen years I've been doing these types of cases. Golf courses are are very hard businesses to make work. They just really, they seem glamorous, they're nice, I love to be out on them, but they're not very good at making money, simply because the cost of keeping them green, the cost of keeping employees, the cost of buying tractors, the cost of repairing irrigation systems, they just, as a business venture, they're very hard to make work, I think, unless you are way east of the Mississippi and maybe the southeast part of the United States or in California. The economics just don't work. So we look at this particular property. This property, as I mentioned, it's about 20 years old. I spoke to the owners of the property. They have, you know, you've heard the concept of deferred maintenance. These are things that need to be taken care of. They have a sprinkler system that apparently caused them a great deal of problem about a year ago, maybe the last couple years, and it's not surprising because it's 20 years old. The numbers on those types of systems run anywhere from 10 to 30 years, 10 to 20 years, depending on the different elements. And I have that highlighted in some of this data behind the first tab. So generally speaking, kind of cutting to the quick, if you will, you know, we see the land value significantly different. And let me address briefly the land value. We looked at some sales. We looked at two particular sales. And some of that data we have, it's behind tab. Tab 4. We looked at, there was a sale of 779 acres, the Emerald Ridge Ranch, which is really, if I'm saying this correctly, I think it's across the valley floor from where Catamount is. And, you know, it's kind of rolling, gentle. It does have nice views as well. One reason we looked at that particular sale is the appraisers talk about land that has river influence and land that is more uplands. I think this one was considered to be more uplands, no river influence, rolling, had some steep elevation, there's some seasonal creeks and ponds, etc. But it was felt to be a representative sale. It sold in September of 2016, and without time adjusting it, it gets you to about 9,000 an acre, just a little bit below that. There was one other sale we looked at, and it's way out on County Road 35. I went out and looked at it at myself as best I could determine where it was. You know, certainly it's uplands again. It looks like it was improved at some point with last year maybe with a home. You know, that one transacted at a little over $12,000 an acre. I'm not sure that that's the best comp in the world. I mean, of the ones I looked at and these two that I have, the one across the valley floor at that Emerald Ridge seemed to be fairly comparable to my eye. So generally speaking, we thought that, you know, land without river influence was ranging between $8,000 and $12,000 an acre. When you look at the property record cards for the subject property that are behind tab 3, you'll see that in many cases, you know, these land parcels are fairly irregular. Their shape is kind of all over the place. As I understand that this land can only be used for a golf course. I don't know that it can be used for anything else. And, you know, really, I just don't see it as being $19,000 an acre. In terms of the county sales, their land sales, they appear behind tab 5. And I'm going to talk in two parts here. You know, I will say this, your representatives from your assessor's office are very good. at least they're very good in my case of providing information to me over the summertime. I really appreciate that. Some of the data changed when they were doing their final report, and some of it I just got to look at this morning. But most of my comments as I prepared for this hearing were based on the data that I was given in June. So the county, they primarily, well, initially they relied on some sales. I was given a report that was prepared by Matt, and it had land sales in it, and I looked at those to try and figure out whether I thought they were good or what, if anything, I could say about them. There were three or four sales that originally he had listed with his Haymaker golf course sales, and they're listed back behind tab four. It was the acquisition that the Gay family did after they sold their big parcel in, I think it was the fall of 16. They came back and then bought four other parcels, 147.47 acres, $3 million, October of 15.
You meant tab 5, I think, right?
Tab 5, okay. Yes. Tab 5 is where those sales are. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Would you start describing those again?
Sure. I'm talking about sales that I was provided by Matt. Land sales to support the $19,000 per acre value. Those are behind tab 5 in my report. The first was a grouping of four sales. I'll just refer them as the Gay sales. In October of 2015, was after they sold, I think it was a Green Creek Ranch. So these parcels sold at roughly $18,987 after you deducted out $200,000. There was one improvement on one of the parcels. So roughly $19,000 an acre. That was one of the grouping of sales relied on by the assessor's office. And again...
Can I just interrupt you for a second? Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm struggling with, and I'm looking at the first land sale behind tab number 5,
mm-hmm.
Which is a 37.6 acre parcel.
Yes.
What was it? I'm not finding the actual sale price. Where is that?
The sale price is down at the bottom of the first page under sale data.
Yep.
You see that deed in October of 15 for $3 million?
Yep. That's the sale price?
That's the sale price for
this 37 acre parcel.
No, this 37 acre parcel as well as the three or four that follow it.
Oh, okay. So it's $3 million for... all of them combined.
Yes, sir. 147.47 acres.
And the ratio is describing what percentage of that sale was attributed to this parcel.
But the bottom line was 147 acres at $3 million.
At roughly $19,000 an acre.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you
very much. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Sorry if I wasn't clear.
No, that's fine.
So with respect to this particular sale, this gets back to this uplands river influence type of thing. The individual I consulted with was familiar with these sales. It was his belief and understanding from looking at this that those four parcels also included about 850 feet of river frontage. They had some irrigated hay meadow, and it also included some 6 CSF of waterways. So I think, you know, there's an adjustment to be made there that I'm not sure was made. I'm not sure that really supports 19,000 an acre. There were two other sales that were initially noted by the county. One was a sale that was outside the base period, and they did indicate that they looked at that, but they didn't give it any weight. There was another sale a 40-acre parcel, I think it was on the valley floor, and that was at about 19,700 an acre. Again, I've mentioned that our parcels all have this irregular shape. I don't really think it can be used for anything other than a golf course. We do know, and I think I mentioned this, in these golf course closures that are happening in some places in the country, most notably Arizona right now, There's all kinds of litigation going on between people who bought homes next to the golf course or are now fighting developers who are trying to develop those courses. You see some of those articles periodically in the Wall Street Journal as well. In this particular case, it's my understanding that they can't do anything with this land other than keep it as a golf course, that it's not developable for homes. Matt's going to talk in a little bit about his report. The report I received this morning had five new sales in there. I'll reserve my comments on those if I can after he makes his presentation. But generally speaking, you know, to sum up where we came from, you know, we see the land value significantly lower. We see the depreciation on the improvements as being significantly greater because you have to look at this external obsolescence issue. Now, the magic with any of this depreciation is trying to quantify it. How do you quantify it? The physical sometimes gets easy because there are tables you can look at. When you're talking about functional obsolescence or external obsolescence, it's a little more subtle in terms of looking at it. So how did I come up with 30%? Well, I looked at things like the decline in membership, 22% over the last decade. I looked at the fact of the short season, which is roughly about a third of what normal golf courses would be, maybe about 60% off. I looked at the rounds played, which again were about 50 to 60%, actually about 60% off of what they would be if you had 25,000 rounds a year and you've only got eight. You know, you're down a bit there. So it's not an exact science. It's simply my estimate on the best I could come up with in terms of looking at this data, as well as all the national data that I talked about earlier. I did mention deferred maintenance. With respect to replacing sprinkler systems, I don't know that they have an exact estimate at Catamount as to what it would take to replace the entire system. I do know from experience with a course 2 years ago, a front range course in the Denver metropolitan area, a private, not-for-profit club was looking at a figure of $2.6 million to replace their entire irrigation system. When you get into the irrigation systems, the issue is, do you need to replace the whole thing, or do you just need to replace pieces of it? I don't know exactly what the answer to that is as it relates to Catamount, but I know that what they have is 20 years old, and I know that it's getting near the end of its life. And I'm estimating that if they had to replace that whole thing today, you know, it would be $3 million, and I'm probably off by a factor of as much as $500,000. I'm just using that number from what I had a couple years ago and increasing a little bit for increased steel costs that we've experienced. They also have told me that they have bunkers. The bunkers out there need to be replaced. I think they have a figure of an estimate of $900,000 to do that. There's some paving that has to be done. And a golf course is kind of like a boat. There's always something to be done. There's always something that's going to need to be replaced. One other thing I just want to mention, and I met with the controller of the club today, Michelle Fraser, and I met with the manager, Mr. Price. We had talked about this over the phone, but I wanted to speak with him to find out if I was able to disclose a certain piece of information in the course of this hearing. We all know that in terms of opinions of value, a couple things. One, cost is going to take you to the higher end. We'll talk a little bit about income is kind of hard to do in a not-for-profit club. This course has been losing money for years. I can tell you that. The piece of information that I've been authorized to share with you is, as a rule of evidence, an owner's opinion of value is admissible as evidence. The owner's opinion of value is even less than what my opinion of value was. I am told that there was, and I don't know if there's written documentation, but I've been informed that at least there was a meeting or conversations between the partnership that owns the golf course and the memberships, the people who are members of the golf course. There was an offer by the owners of the golf course to the members to purchase the golf course for $4 million. The members' response was, no, we'll pay you $0. Just let us take it over and let us assume the other liabilities that exist there. It's something to consider. So I look at what they thought the value was. I think they're looking now. I think their thought is, we're running a golf club and we're going in the hole every year on money. As a developer, you know, they achieved their goal. They went in, they put in a golf course, it helped them sell lots at a very high price. Now it's not making so much money, they'd like to get out. That's somewhat understandable. My number was coming in at about $5 million. That's the value that we requested. I also had a value that I looked at, it could have been as much as $6 million using one of my formulas and adding back in a depreciated cost of the improvements. So I will tell you that I think this story is a work in progress. I've already spoken to Matt. We've had some good conversations about external obsolescence and how to try and quantify it. I was able to share with him this confidential information that I just shared with you right before the hearing. Overall, we're requesting a value of $5 million. We think $19,000 an acre for this land is high. It should be 8 to 12. My $5 million, 5 to $6 million number is based on a $12,000 per acre land value. And I think it's supportable by the existing physical obsolescence at the improvements and in the golf course, and by this external concept of what's happening in the industry generally, and the fact that in this beautiful place that you all live, and it is one of the most beautiful places in the state, I love it here, unfortunately it's a very short season for golf courses, and that impacts its value.
Thank you. All right, we'll turn it over to the assessor's office.
Okay, much of what Tom said was correct, and I agree with them on the methodology, but not so much on the value and certain comps reconciled too. So as he explained, the cost approach was utilized due to a lack of sales of golf courses and due to a lack of income information. Particularly, Catamount is a nonprofit course, so income is not really their driving motivator. But let's start at the vacant land development. Let's start at the national market and what the national data is telling us. So he did quote some statistics from, you know, the National Golf Foundation. And if you go to page 5 of the report, I would point out that through the years 2014 through 2017, we're showing increasing golf participation over the years. So it really indicates a period of stability at this time. We're not seeing participation drop off. And if you look at the cap rates just below that, also on page 5, you really see it's also known as a risk rate, and it's really stable. You look at the time from 2008 to 2018, and that risk rate really hasn't changed any. And again, it just points to a period of stability. We're not seeing any major decline in the national data. And you know, part of it is due to golf courses being closed. There's reduced supply. And if demand is staying the same, that demand has to go somewhere. It goes to the remaining courses. So all else being equal, that actually reduces economic obsolescence, as Tom described that concept. Continuing on to page 6 here, if we look at other national golf companies, they're all showing increasing revenue and gross profit from 2015 through 2018. And really, that's what you would want to compare a golf course to, is a for-profit course acting in their best interests. Whereas if it's a non-profit, losing revenue or declining revenue, it's not as relevant. Going to Colorado data, this is on page 7 of the report. It's also from the National Golf Foundation. This is the mountain region of golf, so it actually includes New Mexico, Arizona, places close to us that also have mountainous regions. And I would point out that if you compare the national golf course data to the mountain region data, we're blowing the national data out of the water. The rounds played are actually increasing in the mountain region. And again, that would indicate that if courses are closing in other places nationally, that demand is going to go somewhere. There is demand in this region. If you go to page 8 of the report, Gary Bynes of the Colorado Golf Association, he quoted that based on the recent data, 2017-2018, that the Denver market in particular, there's 648,000 non-golfers who are interested in playing golf. And it really indicates that Colorado is leading the way of bringing in new participation and new golfers. And really, that's what I would be looking at, more than the national data. I would be looking at a more localized data. Colorado, in particular, it has an active golf industry. We did see that course opening in 2018 in Berthoud. It's also designed by a golf architect. It has reservoirs. It's an 800-acre residential subdivision, so it was designed with a similar purpose in mind as Catamount. And really what that indicates to me is there really isn't that much economic obsolescence if they're bringing online new courses that are premium golf course architect designed. And that said, there is still realized that the industry is facing some struggles. So that, that period in 2000, there was a bust, as Tom suggested. Many golf courses were closed as a result of that. And in consideration of that, there was an element of economic obsolescence applied to the golf course development costs that reduced the value as a result. So going to our specific local Route County data now, there are a number of sales. There are a few sales, I should say. And really, I feel that these bracket the lower end of value of the vacant land. And I'll go into that. If you look at page 12, that's the comparable grid analysis of these vacant land sales. Comparable one, as Tom noted, 147 acres for $3 million in 2015. So this particular sale, it did have that 900 front feet on Yampa River. And I would just point out that the subject parcel, it has 3,700 front feet on Moulton Creek and a 3.5-acre lake. you know, those factors are absolutely offsetting. In addition, the zoning is different. The subject parcel, it has a special use permit for the golf course. It's an entitlement that's above and beyond the comparable one agricultural use. So, you know, not just anyone with agricultural zoning can say, I want to develop a golf course and have it be approved. So that entitlement, it has value. And really, that's why that comp one, it's the value floor. You can subtract out the home, you can give it a $200,000 value, and that indicates a $19,000 per acre value floor, which would be supported by both comp two and comp three. You know, comp three is the closest to the golf course. So as far as the locational influence, it's the most similar. It's somewhat smaller, so you know you can't develop a golf course on 40 acres. So it's really inferior. You have more value to be able to develop a golf course with a larger acreage. Comp 4, that sets the value ceiling. It's superior that they're developing it with residences. That's what I would expect to see if the golf course was subdivided, which there's no indication of that. The association would likely vote against it. They want the golf course there. It adds value to their homes and their lots. So if you look at the comp map on page 13, you can see how these comps relate in position to the subject. So while the subject is irregular, that's true. It was by design, and it goes around the holes. So it's a meandering course, and it actually makes it more expensive to develop, because you have to have, you know, irrigation going to all the various holes, whereas a core course that might have a circular orientation, you can have a branching irrigation system. So Catamount's irrigation system, it certainly is expensive. The figure he quoted to replace the irrigation system is certainly valid, and I've considered that in the analysis. The depreciation, wear and tear to the bunkers and the sprinkler system, it absolutely has to be factored into the valuation.
So cut to the chase here, just a little bit of question I have is, are you proposing to come up with a cost approach or a income approach? Or
yeah, cost approach. The cost approach is reconciled too, because that was the only data we had essentially, so it was the best data.
Okay, keep going.
Yep.
Thank you.
So, you know, we did request the income approach or income data from Catamount a number of times. It would be good to at least have it to be able to analyze it, even though it is nonprofit. It might not necessarily be relevant. It would be good to know it. So in the cost approach, there were a number of items that weren't actually included or considered, things like security systems, underground piping and wiring, landscaping light fixtures, permanent signage, fencing, gates, bridges, masonry walls. All that stuff would normally be picked up in the cost approach, but you know, due to time limitations and just those things were excluded. So again, I'm pointing to the value floor here as my support.
So can you clarify that? I just want to make sure I understand that statement. So you didn't make an estimate of those things.
No,
they just were not included.
They were just not included.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So there is a course development cost. Various things can influence the course development cost. It can range from who you hire as the architect to how steep the topography is, how much grading there is, how many bunkers there are, how many water features there are. The more features there are, the more expensive it is per hole. So I utilize Marshall Swift, and the class 4 cost range per hole, it's anything from $200,000 to over $1 million per hole. And you know, it can go up from there. It depends on numerous factors, even the type of soil. If you're digging into rock or clay, or again, I reconcile to a lower range, $500,000 per hole, as the replacement cost new of what it would cost to just to put in the holes, so that. Then depreciating that, you would take off for things like wear and tear on the sprinkler system, wear and tear on the bunkers. So the overall physical and economic depreciation I applied was 60%. And you know, it's somewhat new, of course. It's 20 years old. It's somewhat modern. Depreciation was factored in. Economic obsolescence was factored in, which is really, it's an unsupported adjustment, economic obsolescence. Because we don't have all the data required to actually settle on an exact economic obsolescence figure. And, you know, I applied 60%, Tom applied 70%. It's at least somewhat subjective and a matter of opinion there. And it's based on observations and cost to cure estimates, and what the broader golf course industry is doing, and the golf course industry in Colorado. You know, if you take off the
question, that, you know what, just muscle me enough because I'm going to keep saying.
So the $500,000 cost per hole, you multiply that by 18. That's a $9 million replacement cost new for the golf course itself. If you subtract off Tom's figure for the sprinkler repair, $3,120,000, and a $900,000 for the bunker repair, you know, that still brings you to a nearly $5 million figure just for the development of the golf course.
That's the cost for development after you own the land.
After you own the land, yeah.
And prior to the depreciation number being.
That's after the depreciation is taken off, and that's also not including buildings like the pro shop, you know, golf cart storage.
Got it. Thank you.
Tom didn't really bring up the issue of valuation of the buildings themselves. I have that value on page 18, how those values were reconciled to. You know, the pro shop on their original filing, I believe it cost around $1.2 million new. I have it factored at around $700,000 new. So really, my costs new to begin with could very well be low. And the $500,000 cost per hole new could very well be low. It could be $750,000. And Tom did allude somewhat to the highest and best use, as far as would it be legally permissible to have any other use other than a golf course? Would it be subdividable? Really, I just considered it as a golf course. If it was considered as a subdividable piece of property, you know, say 35-acre lots, well, there are 35-acre lots selling for $1.7 to $1.8 million adjacent to the Catamount Golf Course. And now...
How many acres is that in?
199 almost.
For 199 for the golf course. And then there's...
Thanks.
So if you add the vacant land value of $19,000, the course development cost, and all the buildings, that's how we arrived at the value of $9.2 million.
Thank you.
So the depreciation, can I
ask? Yes, you may. Go ahead.
So the depreciation, what's the life? What kind of life do you put on this stuff?
So they have different lifespans. So, you know, a sprinkler system could have a life of 30 years, whereas a bunker might only be 20 years. That might require more maintenance.
So, whereas the building. I agree with that. Because, yeah, the building is going to be different as well.
Sure.
It just seems in my mind that a 20-year-old golf course definitely is a 20-year-old golf course. And whether that's a 30-year overall life of the golf course as well, without having to, capitalize.
How long is Augusta National in place?
Yeah, but that's
continual maintenance.
We love their capital budget.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine. I think. I mean, I guess. I understand that your 60% depreciation includes both a factor for economic obsolescence and for physical depreciation, is that correct? And you're breaking that out at 40 and 30, and so really we have 60% versus 70% depreciation. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a way to reconcile what the appropriate amount is, or is it really just an estimate?
It really is an estimate until there's more and better data that would support something else.
Could I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Because how much of your 60 was physical and how much was economic?
It's overall depreciation. I really estimate that it's less physical and more economic.
I mean, just in my mind, I think the course is at least 40% physical all by itself, and it might be more than that. But I left it. That's what I thought. And the external calculation, as I indicated before, quantifying it is the difficult part. I was looking at numbers between 22% and 66%, and I concluded that 30 was supported by both the climbing the membership, the season, and the number of rounds. Just on this property alone, not considering the national data at all.
Can I ask a question? I don't know who might be able to. I imagine either of you could give me some indication about this, but that property is not just used as a golf course. And so if we're looking at just number of rounds, I mean, it has year-round use. And when people buy a membership, it's for year-round use, not just for the golf course. So I struggle with the number of rounds being a question. I guess there are other uses.
It's private. It's private and nonprofit.
Right. So that would
so it's also
the number
limited.
Of rounds.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think what I was thinking on that is.
So what are the other uses out there?
They groom it for
schemes.
Yeah.
Well, is it also available for
events?
Yeah.
I don't know if those are the golf courses, the golf course itself is groomed in the winter, and members have access to cross-country skiing in the winter time.
So I can just make two more points. The shorter golf course season, that was the same case at the time that the course was built. So if there wasn't economic obsolescence at the time, then why would there be economic obsolescence now from that? And the second, the
price. Selling houses then, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
So the 779 acre sale, that's going to realize a huge economy of scale because it's four times as large as the subject parcel. And if he's putting all his weight on that for the vacant land value, I would argue it's not apples to apples. It's
you would argue a higher per acre value
absolutely.
Than that 700 acres.
Absolutely.
So I guess the bigger question for us: where are we going here? Are we going to get anywhere? We just swing this.
So I've got maybe a little bit of help to clarify?
Yeah, we've got more to go.
Questions for the group, for us, yes. I guess, is as much as I would like to think about this property in terms of if you could divide it into 35-acre parcels and sell them as home sites, that is irrelevant information. Is that correct?
It's irrelevant to me, and I don't think it could be split.
Okay, so
that's part of the association would allow it.
And the association wouldn't allow it, and it's the same thing we talked about on a couple other properties we've had this week. So I don't think that's irrelevant.
And is it relevant to compare a private golf course that was built in essence as an amenity to a public golf course that would be operating as a for-profit scheme?
You're asking us.
Yes.
I probably say no, it is not.
I would agree.
And a lot of the value of the golf course has basically been moved over to the owners of the individual homes.
Absolutely. In fact, and we would have seen, you know, the common interest areas that we've seen on other things too. But this owner decided to keep the golf course himself. Why? Would have given that off to the landlord and for common interest.
Hold on just a second. Yeah.
Those are the only two clarifying comments.
Go ahead, Matt.
I'll just say that there's no transfer of value. That it's a theory, and you know, you can plainly see that adjacent lots have their value increased, but it's not that the golf course is transferring value away from itself into to the lots. It's not a zero sum. That's all I'm saying.
You're saying that we consider the golf course upon its own merits.
Upon its own merits.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Two things, if I may, on the public-private concept. You know, those statistics that I received from the Colorado Golf Association were for both public and private courses. There are a lot of, you know, private clubs down in the Front Range all over the state that are included with that higher number of rounds. With respect to this issue of the value transfer, as the saying goes, sometimes this is not my first rodeo with this golf course. Some may remember that we went through this issue back in 2004, 5, or 6, somewhere back there, where we had an appeal that we eventually went to the state on. And one of the issues at that point was the fact that there was some indication of value transfer out to the individual lots. Some of those lots were, in effect, had increased value because they're next to a golf course. So does that value exist in both places, or do you realize it on the sale of the lots? And I think some of the theory was that it's really, you know, the way these things are developed, much like the new one in Denver that, or in Bertha that Matt referred to, you know, they build them to sell lots. So, you know, that may be one of those debatable issues. But there is some support for the theory that some of the land value attributable to the golf course is really kind of recognized in the sale of the lots at the prices that you were mentioning.
So I have one more question for you.
Yes, sir.
It sounds to me like you don't disagree with the assessor that the cost approach was the correct approach to value this property, because there really are no comparable sales. You guys were unwilling to provide income data. So the cost approach is correct, in your view, as long as we factor in the depreciation, and you disagree with the cost per acre of the land.
I'm saying for purposes of this analysis, we decided not to challenge the overall cost approach. We thought we'd try and keep the ball game within the parameters of the way it was started, looking at a cost approach and seeing if that made sense. I mean, if this case goes forward, it'll be up to an appraiser to decide whether or not an income approach or a sales approach would be appropriate. We know, I mean, both Matt and I know, in terms of sales in Colorado, there really haven't been any good sales. There was a sale down in the Golden area. The numbers mentioned it was mentioned in the initial data that Matt provided to me, but that sale in no way reflected the appraised value of that particular golf course. As I've talked to the appraiser who did that work, there were other things at play in that number. So if we're going to do a sales approach, we probably have to go to national data. And that has its own dilemma then in adjusting for locale and location. On the income approach, you know, I mean, quite frankly, we thought at this stage of the game, you know, if this case goes forward, there's a statute that says that we have to provide the income data. This club has been operating at a loss. It's a not-for-profit. I just didn't see that it was particularly helpful or valuable. I thought we'd try and find as many points of commonality as we could, but we still have differences on land value and depreciation.
I guess the bigger question for us, I'm thinking here, this thing's, we're not probably, I mean, it's great education here.
Yeah.
And some good information and stuff, but I don't think we're going to come up with a rocket science finish here.
I don't either.
I've been doing my math as hard as I can, and I can't.
I'm inclined to just state that this is obviously very complicated, valuing golf courses, and you've done a wonderful job explaining all of this to us, and I don't think we're going to come up with anything better than either of the two of you.
And then at that point in time, we might as well just deny the appeal.
Yes.
That way it reserves all the rights, and that way they can, you know, they guys can continue working at the table, working across the table, and come up with some stipulation on it. I keep saying we're not trying to, get rich off of this whole scheme. We're just trying to do it equal and fair on everybody. So, I think...
I feel the same way about it. I think that we either would deny it or we would somehow split the baby, and I don't see any real reasonable way to try to adjust the valuation at this point that makes any sense to me based on what I've heard.
I agree.
Okay. Well, let's keep moving then.
So
good Lord, I am so ready, Doug.
So there's three parcels here, is that correct then?
Yes, sir.
I can read off the numbers for you.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, regarding the three parcels here, read off those three parcels.
Actually, why don't you go ahead and do it here?
Okay. R816-4217. R816-4218 and R816-4221.
I move that we, on those three parcels, I would move that we deny the appeal and
uphold
the values that were provided by the County Assessor's Office.
Second.
Other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
The decision, I'm sure you're aware, can be appealed to the Robb County District Court. The State Board of Assessment appeals it through an arbitration process, and you'll receive a letter informing you of the decision and your rights concerning that process.
Thank you very much. It is a complicated issue.
It is.
Thank you, Matt.
And I would comment.
Yeah.
It was an excellent presentation.
We'll talk.
Thank you very much.
Right. We'll be talking.
How many more do we have from you?
One.
Okay.
This one's a whole lot easier, I think.
Well, it's a pleasure to listen to you share your information. Not everyone is so well prepared.
Not his first day at the rodeo.
I know. It's not his first rodeo. He got a rodeo metaphor and a skiing metaphor in there.
Yeah. Working it.
How many metaphors do you have for us today, Kevin?
I haven't thought of any yet.
Okay. All right.
I do want to update the sales comparison map when we get to my reports. That's
all right. Let me go ahead and this is just one account number. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so it's R816-6714, the clubhouse at Lake Catamount. So we will find these here real quick.
Page 125.
Yeah. Got it? I think and this is the staff packet. That's just the notice of determination. Yeah. All right. Petitioner and the assessor appraiser have been sworn in, so we'll go ahead and get started with the petitioner.
I'll give you the good news right off the bat is I don't have as much to say about this one.
That's great news.
Yes. So you have a small packet in front of you, not too dissimilar to the one you saw the last go around. Property record card of the petitioner, which is kind of behind tab A. This kind of summarizes where the values are. Currently valued at $3,001,060, with $1,416,800 attributable to the land and the remainder to the improvements. After tab B, you have the property record card out of the assessor's office. Tab C, I just put a couple things in there showing that there's a conservation easement of record. And then tab D, I'm going to go through tab D, but again, as I've said earlier, the folks in your assessor's office are very good about trying to provide people information during the protest period. And Kevin, Mr. Krause did. He provided me with the land sales that you see behind tab D. And those are the ones that I looked at and considered when I was getting ready for our presentation today. Kevin did some updating of his report on Friday, added some additional land sales that I saw this morning. But I'm going to talk about the ones that I first looked at, and then I'll talk about the new ones after Kevin presents, if that's okay.
Yes.
During the exchange this summer, I mean, really, I just got some land sale data. I didn't really get, nor do I recall specifically requesting. It gets busy during this protest period for cost data on the improvements. But I really didn't know exactly how the improvements had been valued. We kind of looked at the overall value. We thought it was high. I requested data on the land sales, and that's what was provided to me behind tab D. So again, you know, quick overall bird's eye view. I mean, we see the value at somewhere slightly over $2 million. I think we requested $2,190,600 in our petition. As I was going back through and reworking the numbers, I came to a number that was slightly below that, but somewhere between $2 million and $2,200,000. With respect to looking at tab D of my report, and again, until this morning, this is the only data I had as to how they were coming up with the land value. Original land value is $110,000 an acre. And these three sales in tab D that are in this were offered in support of that. So I looked at them and I see, you know, one sold for $134,000 an acre, one sold for $67,000 an acre, one sold for $20,947.
So can I interrupt for a minute? I'm just a little confused. I'm looking at this sheet and I'm looking at this bottom line, the cost per acre.
That's the value per acre. If you go up about three spaces, there's a sale price per acre.
Okay.
The third line from the bottom. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
No, that's my fault. I wasn't paying attention.
So I looked at this and I see 134, 67, and 20, and I go, how the heck do you get to 110? I mean, if I average those three, they're about 74,000. You look at, you know, a median, it's the 67,000 number. Comp number one is, you know, about half the size of the subject property. I think that's, and that was the highest range sale. The Priest Creek property was right in the middle at 67.4 and was closest in size. The other thing it was closest to is the June 30, 2018 date. So I kind of looked at that, and I said to myself, well, if I had to pick any of these three, I'd kind of look at that one. Now, I will tell you this, and if for those of you who have been out to the lake clubhouse out there, it's a primo piece of property. You walk through that front door, and you look all the way through, and you see the lake. There's no denying it is a very nice piece of ground. The question is whether it's $110,000 an acre nice. And I looked at these three sales and was saying, I can't get there. I look at sale two and I say to myself, well, closest in size, closest to June 30. The county thought it was a comparable. And, you know, maybe you adjust that sale because this one sits out at the lake. You know, mentally I adjusted it 20% and came up with a number that was just under 81,000 an acre and kind of utilized that as I was coming up with my number that was at the $2,190,000 number. There are some other sales that Kevin's going to talk about, and then I'll briefly address those after he does. But this is what I was looking at throughout the course of the summer in terms of trying to understand the land value on this property. What I didn't know is how the improvements were being valued, and I'll let Kevin address that. I understand he's done a cost approach, and I believe that the this property is, again, 18 to 20 years old. I believe, and Kevin will correct me, that the physical depreciation allowed was 17%.
Yeah, and 19 on the main clubhouse and 19 on the boathouse.
And
say that how you present it.
Yeah. And obviously, I think that's too low for a property that's 18 to 20 years old. I did mention to Kevin this morning when we saw each other that there are a number of deferred maintenance items. And I know Kevin was out there on Friday and saw some things. That there's been some work done since the first of the year. Some of that expansion of the deck has just happened. They had to replace some deck, and they expanded the deck to the tune of $35,000. Kevin's going to tell you that in his initial value, he didn't think he picked up any value for the tennis courts, and now he has. They have an estimate. I mean, the tennis courts need about $70,000. It's very expensive resurfacing or refurbishing tennis courts, and that's the estimate that they have. There are some other things that have to happen out there that are scheduled to happen. Some are refurbishing, and some are actually expansion issues, but some are refurbishing in the kitchen and the floor. There's an estimate there of about $160,000. In any event, their laundry list, if you will, of deferred maintenance items total about $360,000. And I think I'll reserve the rest of my comments after Kevin presents, if that's okay.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead, Kevin.
Okay. So I updated you with this corrected sales map. The other one had too many comp ones, so we'll refer to the updated version. Before we get started, Tom was in this morning, and we did talk about depreciation. He asked me a little bit if I used Marshall and Swift to develop that. And at that time, I told him it primarily is the depreciation on both of the main improvements is based on our general tables in the Tyler system for the reappraisal, which is up to this year is around 1999 to 2001 is about 1% of the year. Because he asked that, I went ahead and I pulled some stuff I had looked at prior when I was putting this CBOE report together. And these are the what Marshall and Swift shows for depreciation for these types of buildings. I've also got another, this is just a very general matrix that shows some samples that were taken from sales to extract the depreciation, comparing the sales price of a comparable to what it would cost to build it. It's a good way to do overall depreciation. These are nothing like the subject. I mean, we're looking at funeral home, retail, warehouse, shop, and so forth. So just to kind of get us on board with that. And what had happened with this, historically this property, it is very unique. I mean, there are others around the state, but for Routt County, it really is a very unique property in that it has that lake frontage, the nice clubhouse, and so forth, and the arrangement where it's made available to participating members of Catamount subdivision. But historically, this account has had a commercial land model on it, and there's never been a model reflective of that area for commercial parcels. And the land tier that was in there was based on properties up in Northwest Steamboat and Heritage area. It was based on per acre. And when Tom first appealed this, his concern was, you know, how do you support the value on this? And I looked at that and I thought, you know, this needs to be changed. And then going in and looking at the comparables that are actually out there, the land sales that are out there, I could see why whoever originally set up the commercial land model at the time used that area up there. It was a very similar price scheme for what the total calculation was on it. But because we were scrutinizing the property and, you know, I thought, you know, that's not right moving forward, that needs to be changed. I went ahead and looked at period sales only, vacant land sales in the Catamount area. And knowing that this subject property was a lake frontage property, I wanted other lake frontage properties, or at least property sales that had some sort of water amenity, to see, you know, if we could come up with a meaningful way of supporting the value. I want to go back over to Tom's tab D.
D.
Yeah. These are the initial sales that I sent him, and I just in a very brief email said, Tom, these are all about a base value of $1 million for a site, a buildable site in this neighborhood. None of them have water frontage or lake frontage. Some of them have some water amenity, but it's nothing like what this particular property has, and nothing like a couple of the comparable sales that are in the subdivision. These sales were initially given to Tom because they were within the period. I was trying to stay within the period. But one thing I want to draw your attention to is Comp 1, $895,000. Comp 2, $980,000. Comp 3, $1,048,000. Now look above that. Comp 1 is only 6.64 acres. Comp 2 is 15 acres. And lo and behold, Comp 3 is 50 acres. And there are other things going on here, but the gist of the story is people in this area are paying for that primary site value. The additional acreage is generally considered surplus acreage. So, you know, I'm inclined, like Tom is, to go in and look, okay, what is this per acre? If you do it on a per acre basis, it is not meaningful. It's not reality of what's going on out there. And going back to these comps, let's round them to 100,000. They're all right around a million. And the
round them to
the nearest 100,000. Yeah, they're right around a million for that base value.
Oh, okay.
And we know historically, both Gary has done the Res 10 model, or the Res 10. Angela's currently doing it on the residential basis out there. And it's been established that anything that has lake frontage is about a 40 to 50% in adjustment. So when I initially sent those comps to Tom, I'm looking at, okay, about a million. You add 40, 50%, you're going to be up over what we have the parcel valued at for the time period, which was $1,416,000. As things evolved in the appeal process, I got with Gary. And I had worked on a grid a little bit using these initial three comparables. And Gary and I both felt like, you know, none of the sales that have occurred going back 5 years prior to the date, which is statutorily allowable, ever had a time trend. So we decided it would be more meaningful to take sales that are actually in the subdivision and look at those that had the water frontage, and those that did not, and some other, you know, differences. So that's why that changed. It did evolve, and I know it made it confusing for Tom coming in here. I wasn't trying to pull the rug out from under him, but it was just a matter of the timing and getting the report done and what data we were really starting to look at and scrutinize on this. So if you don't mind, if you go to page 3 of my report, I'll just try to go through this quickly, because it's pretty straightforward. The first two sales, comps 1 and 2, and refer to the new comp map. They're on the east side of the lake, and they are the two that have water frontage. They are the old sales, but because they have that lake frontage, they're being analyzed. Again, there's not a time trend on any of these reappraisal periods. If you go to comp 3, that is actually just north of the subject property. It has no water frontage. And because the acreage or the size of a given parcel isn't that big of a factor as far as on a per acre basis, there's just a nominal downward adjustment made on all of these. They are all larger. The subject's only just short of 13 acres. The others are 35 to 40 acres. But there's a nominal 5% downward adjustment on that. But going back to comp 3, the contours of the property are similar to the subject. Access is similar. It's real close to Ralph County Road 18. It has a lake view. It doesn't have lake frontage. And all of these comparables are zoned AF. They don't have the special privileges of the PUD, such as the subject property. If we go to comp 4, there's adjustments made. Comp 4, you can see, is up in the northeast or the east side, but not a lake frontage property. There's a larger adjustment of 15% made for its steepness and buildability, essentially. Its access is inferior, as you've got to come around from 18. And it doesn't have lake frontage, so that 40% adjustment is made to that. If we go to comp 5, this was one of the comparables that I initially sent to Tom because it was in the subdivision. It was a period sale. However, it is not a lake frontage property, and it also has a lot of grade or topography issues and timber and so forth as far as buildability. And adjustments made to that, again, 15% for the slope. The access is slightly more difficult or time-consuming. Again, it doesn't have lake frontage. There's a 40% adjustment up on that, and again, for the zoning. And going back to comps 1 and 2, the two that are lake frontage, of course, they don't have the 40% adjustment. They do have a slight adjustment upward for the access on the east side of the lake. So in taking these sales, they support the valuation that was set forth in the 2019 reappraisal on the land value. I just reconciled $1,450,000. The system value is actually $1,416,000. So just on the land, and let me do the whole package if you don't mind. That's where we're coming from on the land. And when I was out there Friday, I did take a picture of the tennis courts. There you go. And Tom mentioned there's $70,000.
That's what they...
But I just wanted to show the condition of what I saw when I was out there. And again, maybe something has been done since the assessment date. But they look like they're in pretty good shape. So I'm a little bit kind of questioning that $70,000 estimate for repairs or whatever they're going to do. And that may very well be. And I just want to show you, though, they're not in terrible condition. These are done on an XFOB, so they're an extra in the account, and they historically have not been in the account. So when I went out there, it's like, that's got to be added.
$69,200?
Yeah. And I choose Marshall and Swift to do that.
What's being added to
that? The tennis courts.
Yeah. They weren't
on the inventory.
Okay.
Nope. Another thing that I didn't have good information on. There's the clubhouse building, which is the main clubhouse at the beginning of the property as you go in on the drive. And then down on the lakefront is what they call the Outfitters Clubhouse. And it's just a small little, I don't want to call it inferior, it's a nice quality building, but it's very just utilitarian. It's got an open from the north side to the south side, kind of a walk-through, and it's got decking all the way around it, a covered deck. But I didn't have measurements on that. I just had the square footage that showed 1,200 square feet. So I checked it, and it was off by 2 feet on one end and I think about a foot on the other. All in all, it measured 1,333 square feet instead of the 1,200 that was in the account. So I modified that in the account to calculate properly, and then when I did the cost approach. So now if you would like to go to
just for the record, I know I couldn't play on that. And I can't play anymore.
I used to be able to.
We'll make sure that's noted for the record.
No conflict of interest.
Okay. If you refer to page 6, it's where I start the cost approach and essentially estimating the site improvements. You can see, and I really focused on the finished landscaped area that's, if you look at the, on page 15 of my report, it shows the subject parcel, but the quadrant that is adjacent to the lake, sandwiched in by the drive, is really the area that is mostly landscaped. To the north around the courts and so forth is pretty rough. So in the site improvements, I'm calculating the asphalt, landscaping, and impact fees or tap fees and so forth to come to that $660,000. It is depreciated. I also, I did refer to Marshall and Swift on some of that for the hard items like grading and pavement and the landscaping. So the site improvements are at $660,357. If you go to page 7, I'm looking at the main clubhouse building, and I'll try to make this quick, but essentially it's 6,767 square feet. I'm rating it at very good quality. In Marshall and Swift, on this particular type of building, clubhouses, Class D, which is wood frame structure, there's good and then excellent. And I interpolated the two because I feel like it's right in between them. So that base rate that I put in there of 198 is an interpolation of those two rates. And then the pool is in place there at $116,540. That was just the XFOB value in the system. It's based on Marshall and Swift. That was something I didn't do in this report, but it was already a calculated value. Added the tennis courts, again, from Marshall and Swift on cost to construct. So the total cost new of the commercial building improvements before there was a current cost multiplier was $1,445,708. With the multiplier added for this building anyway, it brought it to $1,546,908. And then the local Steamboat Springs multiplier, it takes it to that $1,778,944. And again, I talked a little bit about the depreciation. This is how the system's calculating on this particular model at 1% a year. The effective age is estimated at 2001. So 2018, it's 17%. And then there's entrepreneurial profit added onto that. So the total on the...
So entrepreneurial profit is part of the cost calculation.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So the final value on this structure is $1,624,176 or $240 a square foot. And the little guy down on the lake essentially did the same thing. And that calculated, again, these are depreciated at $212,059 or $159 a square foot. When the site improvements, the site value, the two structures and the XFOBs are all summed together, we're at $3,950,000. It's rounded. That in working on this, I was looking at how the models were calculating, and I realized that the account was set on the market approach for both structures and the building class and the quality, two different settings, were on really low-grade settings that were incorrect. I corrected them to where they should be, at least good to very good quality. And in doing that, the model calculated significantly higher. So in this cost approach, this is just by hand what I did. But when the system's corrected with the inventory corrections made, as well as, with the inventory corrections made and then the corrections made to the calculating fields, the system calculates to $3,621,350. And I feel like the land value is correct and where it should have been and where it should stay. But I do believe that the improvements are undervalued. And Gary and I talked about this Friday night considerably. And we believe that you should seriously consider making an upward adjustment to the improvements, which increases the total value of the account. And I know Tom's original intent was not to even go down the road of the improvements, but when we appeal in Colorado, we all know that the entire property has to be looked at. And that's what I've done here. So we're just asking that you uphold that or increase it to that, upholding the prior value, but increasing it because of the corrections made. And one thing I did want to point out, and I summarized it in the unredacted version of my report, and this here is the personal property declaration that was provided to the personal property appraiser. And
sorry,
go ahead. Yeah. And this here on the third page, where there's some markups on it, the yellow, if you go down below, they do have in here the acquired value of Lake Catamount Clubhouse land at $1,516 and some change. They've got the acquired value of the clubhouse, the main clubhouse, at $5,356 and some change. And then on down to the Outfitter Center Boathouse at $577,000. If you go to the far right column, it shows the up-to-date. And I know we're looking at 2001, but the way they're handling it here, the depreciation is itemized on each one of those. And when all of that's done, the calculation, if this was an appraisal, and it's not, this is not a real estate appraisal. It's a totally different, it's done for a different purpose, different reason. But I felt like it was pertinent information to at least look at and consider in what I'm coming up with my conclusion. But the total of that depreciation or the depreciated value is $4,991,273. So again, just asking that you do increase this value to the total of $3,621,350 to make those corrections and uphold the original value.
$3,000.
So the last page you have it at $250. So I just wanted to verify. So it's $250 that you're requesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, it's not $350. It's $200.
Well, we'll do the $250 since there's an error on that.
And respond.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's always a pleasure protesting a property for a taxpayer and then having the assessor kind of come back and want to increase the value. Our protest was originally based on the overall value. In my letter, I specifically asked for the basis of the land value, but when you protest, you put everything at issue. I get that. But if you're going to raise the value of this property, don't do it on the basis of what you've heard today from Kevin. I mean, this last bit of information has to do with federal income tax purposes. It's got absolutely nothing to do with real property and fair market value. And I, quite frankly, if that's what you're in part relying on to support the increase, I think it undercuts your argument. The other thing they say is when we come to these hearings that it's our burden to show that the value was incorrect. I think we've done that, but I think Kevin has done that himself. And he's talked about how when they first looked at this, they didn't look at the tennis courts, and there's a slight error in square footage on the outfitter's clubhouse. And now that we're looking at everything, all of a sudden we've got things being upgraded. I understand that, and believe me, I do understand that this is not a real art. It's difficult to value everything correctly the first go around. Stuff gets done a certain way, and it just kind of stays that way. And we all discover things as we're going along. But, I mean, we got a laundry list of things here, which kind of would indicate that first value was not correct. So the question is whether you really have enough data to believe that the original assigned value was correct, or whether you have enough data to believe that the slight increase, the $600,000 increase they're asking for, is correct. And I submit that you don't. I talked about the old sales data that was first provided to me before this morning. I told you that county comp number two I looked at as the closest in size, the closest to our assessment cutoff period. I increased that by 20% to get to roughly an $81,000 figure. Kevin, in his presentation, said that they view the lake influence as a 40% adjustment. If you did 40% to that sale too, you get to $94,418 an acre. Not the $112,578 that they're asking for now. With respect to the new sales, four of them were 35-acre parcels. One was a 40-acre parcel. The subject is 12.88 acres. The subject is not a parcel that is available for residential development. I mean, it's a PUD. It's in some ways, it's not too dissimilar to the golf course. It's an amenity that was added to sell lots at an increased price. You know, the use of the subject property is not the same use as any of these comparable sales. These are all meant for residential development. And I'm not sure I really agree with the argument that Kevin is advancing, that maybe anything after 12 acres is really excess land and really doesn't appreciate or doesn't really add to the overall value. You have to ask yourself, why are these people paying these terrific sums of money for these large parcels of property? And I think most of them will tell you it's a privacy issue. They like the seclusion. You know, there is some value to that property that our property doesn't have. We've got 12 acres. That's a clubhouse by a PUD, and, you know, probably is always going to stay a clubhouse, not going to be developed with a residential property. One could argue that potentially that development with that use possibly evidences some functional obsolescence. Maybe the highest and best use would be to scrape that thing and put a house in there. But that's not going to happen. We have to take the property as we find it. It's a clubhouse. You don't have too many clubhouse-type properties in the county. Kevin and I talked about that. I tried to find some. I found one, I can't remember where it was, but it bore no relationship to what this thing looks like, so I didn't spend much time with it. When I look at these other sales, yes, they're all around the lake. Yes, they all sold for a lot of money. But when you look at the adjustments on these sales, when you go to page 3 of Kevin's report, you look at the net adjustments, at least with sales 3, 4, and 5. Now, over the years, I've heard there's somewhat of a rule of thumb in the appraisal world that if you've got a comparable and you're looking at it and your adjustments start approaching 50%, you've got to say to yourself, maybe I've got the wrong comparable. That may just be too much of an adjustment to make this really a good comparable sale. So I would argue that that exists with respect to sales 3, 4, and 5 that have 45, 65, and 60% adjustments to them. Sales 1 and 2 are only adjusted 10%. And I do take some issue that maybe the size adjustment should be more. There's the argument that sometimes smaller properties sell for more. Higher square footage, price per square foot. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily work in the mountain communities. The adjustment at 5%, it should be more since we're essentially maybe about a third the size of those 35-acre parcels. So they're there for your consideration. I think they're convenient in the sense that they support the original assigned value of $110,000, but I'm not so sure that they really are a good comp for this property. On the cost data, Kevin took you through his report at pages 6, 7, and 8. And, you know, as I looked through them, I kept looking for the adjustments for the depreciation, for physical depreciation. I mean, when I looked at the site improvements, I don't necessarily see it there. I guess what you're saying is somehow it's in the calculator.
It's calculated into the matrix.
But we don't know what the physical depreciation is that was applied to the site.
It was 22%.
22%. Is it stated in here? Am I missing it?
No, it's not stated. I did state that it's already depreciated, and it was a time issue.
Okay. I just couldn't see it. That's why I'm asking. And on page 7, we have the main clubhouse that has 17% depreciation for a property that was constructed in, was it 2000?
2001.
Yep. I mean, I would submit to you, and I don't know, with respect to the Marshall Swift tables that you provided, you know, is there anything on these tables that would apply to this clubhouse?
Can you specify your question?
Well, I mean, you gave us, these are life expectancy guidelines.
Well, you got to go through all three pages to understand the conclusion on that. Okay. If you'd like, I can elaborate on it.
Well, I guess my question is, can I determine 17% from looking at these tables?
Yes.
And just tell me how you got to 17%.
Okay, looking at the life expectancy page. This is a handout that I gave you. The first page is the main clubhouse. The second page would be the outfitter's boathouse. But on the first one, this is a very general tool that can really be used to check the reasonableness. And when you're lacking data, oftentimes it's used as a primary source of calculating depreciation. And keep in mind, this property is unique. There isn't data in Rock County. So let's look at this. And I'm looking at country clubs, good to excellent quality, and Class D is wood frame structures, 45%. C, oftentimes on these classes, they blend a little bit, and I highlighted the C category because it's in that range, in my opinion. That's a subjective judgment.
The 50, is that depreciation or estimated life expectancy?
The life expectancy.
Okay, 50 years.
Yes. And then on the second page, it's the same thing that I'm looking at. I'm looking at retail stores, good and excellent. It really was the best representation of what the building was being used for and also in how it's constructed. I also pulled the residential cost book and and looked at what rates per square foot were on that when I did the cost approach. But as far as depreciation, and then my final methodology of calculating the value was based on that category. And then going back to the third page, looking at the depreciation of commercial properties, just going down to effective age in years, the clubhouse, the main clubhouse is at 17 years, and then the outfitter at 19, and I'm highlighting the range. This depreciation is showing with a life expectancy on the low end, the way I've highlighted it, 45 years, and on the high end, 55 years. It's a straight line depreciation method that they use in here, but they do say it does consider some maintenance and renovation over the years. Just viewing the property, and you can see the photos in the report, it's highly maintained overall. And I think there are some issues that Tom mentioned, but that's how I felt. If he was looking at that.
Are you back? Do you want to say something, Tim?
Yeah, I actually don't have any questions.
Okay, great.
I have a couple of comments.
Okay, go ahead.
As far as the building improvements are concerned, I'm in agreement with the assessor. I mean, I've been just simply looking to the bottom line of the value per square foot of the clubhouse, including all of the adjustments, $240 a square foot. Seems reasonable to me, and the same thing for the other building. And unfortunately, it really feels kind of crappy when we do go back and find these things. We have to add them on, but that is what it is. I find myself, though, as far as land value, to be persuaded by the appellant that. And again, the appellate said as much. This is an art form, and it's just really hard to come down and say that there's an exact dollar number per square foot. I understand the assessor's reasoning, how he got to his cost per acre, but I'm kind of inclined to support some adjustment in favor of the appellant.
That sounds great.
So, any science to that, or I'm following your the X, Y.
I mean, the science to me is I'm persuaded that, I mean, on the one hand, we sometimes think that the building lot has a value based upon its value as a building lot,
right.
and that there's no significant difference between a 35 acre parcel and a 12 or 13 acre parcel because you have to build a house there. But I think this is stretching that logic too far, and that we do need to make a downwards adjustment per acre. And so, using the appellant's logic, that the real value should be closer to $81,000 per acre at 12.88 acres. That would give you a land value of $1,043,280, which I think is comparable to the appellants looking at the lot number 2.
I don't think you need to.
Yeah, I got gotcha.
Yeah,
that was the number that stood out to me too.
So all we need to do now is to figure
I've got
out.
It. So I've got. I've got.
You've got
a total
I've
value.
Got, I've got a proposal here. Okay. So I would retain the improvement.
Do you want to just make it as a motion? So
for just
if we agree with you, we can keep going.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I just come up with.
Because I understand what you're saying.
On the total, whatever that total is.
Okay.
Because it was 3621 350.
Yeah, and that was actually the one
that's
question.
The requested. I mean, it's currently $3,001,000.
But I think what I hear is that we want to go with
60.
The improvement valuation requested by the assessor
$81,000.
But I had to have the assessor did need to answer one question for me. How did you, help me understand the adjustment you made from $3,950,000 down to $3,620,000.
No, that's not what he did. He adjusted up.
No, no. So
no, there's a difference. There's a difference.
Process,
yeah.
He got
yeah.
to $3,950,000.
Oh,
yeah. And then he somehow he adjusted down to $3,621,000. Yeah. $350,000. Help me understand.
The reason I'm showing you three different numbers there is that first number, I'm sure we got them in the right order, about
$3,950,000.
Yeah, that one is actually that is actually based on the manual calculation of Marshall and Swift at the CBOE level in this report that I did when I got to go in and scrutinize what was going on.
Correct.
Once I correlated with what was happening in the model and realized, hey, these are not set properly, I set the model on those two adjustments to where it should have been. Also made the inventory corrections on the tennis courts, adding them, and then the square footage change on the boathouse. And the system calculated, without playing around with it, it calculated the 3-6 number.
Okay, fine. Yes. That's good enough for me. So,
wait a second.
So, let's double check your calculations.
Yeah, so the 3621,350. You're going to subtract so many dollars for the land sale reduction.
Yeah.
Okay.
If this will help you at all, I'm retaining the site value at $1,836,235. I'm retaining the my numbers don't error.
Yeah.
So let's all make sure we agree on the same the way we're
I'm
trying to calculate this is the right.
Yeah. So we take the 3621,350, subtract out the 1,000,004, and then put in whatever the number is going to be.
So Kevin, the improved value the value of the improvements that you were requesting is that? Can you? So I see that that's the 1,624,176 plus the 212,059. Do I have that right or no?
The when you back the 1,450,000, actually it's 1,016,000 and some change. When you back that off of the 3.6, the new improved value in the system would be 2,204,000.
Can you tell me what you did again so I can try to follow? You got the 3,621,250.
Right, and actually this would be deduct the the original site value from
1,450,000.
And then you have add back in the new stuff.
Somebody asked
of
the improvements.
The value of the improvements.
To get to the value, the new value of the improvements with the corrections, it's $2,204,550 just for the improvements. Then you would need to add the new revised site value to that.
Okay, I got it.
What is the
and you were at $1,081,000. Is that what it was?
I think he was at $81,000 an acre, right?
I'm
still questioning
the
two million too. How did you get the
land?
I have the land value at $1,043,280. $1,043,280, and I would add to that this new amount for the site improvements. $2,204,000, correct?
Yeah, it's
$550,000,
right?
Which will give me a revised value of $3,247,830.
So I think we're just double checking.
$1,416,000 and not $1,450,000.
That was the original value that was in the system. This is calculating the original value in the system with the modifications. The 1450 was the hand site value I rounded to when I did the cost approach.
So again,
but the system's at $1,416,000. You know, I think we're in the ballpark at either one on that.
I feel comfortable that we're in the ballpark.
Yeah, I think we're in
the ballpark. So, Madam Chair, in the matter of account number R8166714, I would move to deny the petitioner's reduction in value request for reduction in value, and I've also moved to deny the assessor's request for an increase in value, and rather set the value of this property at $3,247,830.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Thanks.
All right. You're aware of your rights regarding appeal?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Good to see you all.
All right. We have one more.
Walmart. Lucky you.
Save the best for last.
Please. Unless this isn't going to take very long.
And it's going to be really quick.
Good.
Really?
That's what I had my fingers crossed. All right. So we're, thank you.
See you, Tom.
Okay. Have you been sworn in? I don't think we've seen you. Yeah, okay. That's what I thought.
Okay.
Yeah, you're good. Okay. So we're ready to hear the appeal for schedule number. Does it start with a P, really?
P025-4242.
And the petitioner is not present, and we'll just swear in the representative from the assessor's office. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
I do.
Thank you. Will you remind me your name? I'm sorry.
Kathy Hutchinson.
Thanks.
Nice to meet you. Really quickly, Walmart has requested an administrative denial. Their argument is overvaluation for the personal property. Value does not take into account external and additional physical obsolescence typical to big box retailers in today's economy.
We are familiar with this argument.
Mm-hmm. And I feel as though it is apples to oranges in our county. Our Walmart doesn't have a big box competitor. The closest big box store to us is 45 miles away in Moffat County. So it's a non-existent issue with regards to that particular point. Their next issue was the overvaluation. We use the Colorado Division of Property Taxation Property Depreciation Tables. And that is
ready for motion?
I'm so ready.
Hey, let me think about it.
Let's get some more information.
Do it. No.
No discussion.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to tell you. P025-4242. We'll be talking to me tonight. That is not
good. Just have the whole
tournament.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Kathy Hutchinson. All right. Thank you.
We are.